Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we get to my guest this week, we'll do that in just a minute. I wanted to remind you on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio, posting a lot of fun videos every week. Go check them out. We've got some new stuff there, youtube.com/PaulMercurio, and you can subscribe there as well. And also send the links around to your friends, your family, and get them to subscribe also. I will come to your house and bake you a cake. I also wanted to talk about just what's going on with this COVID-19, and we're having to stay in place. And I was at the park. You know, they say this is a time when you're able to do things you normally don't do. And I have been, you know, been relaxing, taking more time to think about things. And in fact, the other day, I just at the park, Central Park, and just sat, and a squirrel came up to me, and I just sat looking at the squirrel. It was very peaceful for about 30 seconds. And then the squirrel was making me very anxious, because squirrels are very nervous eaters. They're always looking around. It's like they're in prison and they don't want anybody to take their food. There's a lot of gnawing and looking to the left and looking to the right. I was very stressed out relaxing with a squirrel. And by the way, they don't just eat nuts. I turned my back for a second, my entire foot-long Subway sandwich gone. And he had a little pickle on his little snout there, so I know, I'm pretty sure it was the squirrel. My guest this week, Richard Engel, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for NBC News. Really terrific conversation with him. I've been wanting to talk to him. I think he's one of the best reporters out there, especially regarding world events. And really, really interesting conversation with him about all things going on in the world. COVID-19, the world's reaction to it, how he reports in war-torn regions, and how he doesn't stays alive. It's just a really, really interesting conversation that gets into how he does what he does, his process, and also his perspective on a whole host of issues affecting everybody around the world. So enjoy that. I'm really excited to have him on, and check out the YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. Welcome to the show, special edition. We're doing an international interview. I feel very, very sophisticated and very on top of it, with NBC News Chief Foreign Correspondent, host of On Assignment, Richard Engel, who also does terrific reporting for Today and the Nightly News with Lester Holt, and also on MSNBC. Great to have you on, and thanks for taking time. I've told you off air that I was really been a big follower and admirer and a fan of your work, so I'm really, really excited to have you on.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here and look forward to talking to you. I listened to some of your other interviews and really enjoyed them. So
thanks. It's a great did you have a baby recently or did you guys have recent?
We did have a baby recently. I was just playing with him outside a few minutes ago, literally put him down and came in to do this. And so we have two children. So my wife and I have a four and a half year old and an 8 month old.
Oh my gosh.
So the uncle is great. He's starting to crawl. He looks like he wants to walk any day. He likes really to be physical and to, you know, sort of tumble around and climb on things, which is wonderful. And our son Henry, you don't know if you know this, has pretty severe special needs. Oh. So he's doing okay. You know, we're doing the best we can with him, and we're trying to keep him healthy and safe because people who are, you know, of fragile health would be more susceptible in this time. But so far, knock wood, he's doing great.
So you've been traveling the world for years. Once you got married and started having kids, did the wife have the conversation like, hey, you got to pull back a little bit, or did she take your passport from you for a while or anything like that?
No, not really. I got married. Well, truth be told, this is my second go around. So the first time didn't go quite as well. The second time, Mary, and we have two kids together. Yeah. First one was very quick and early on. I think at this stage, we're both a little bit older in our lives. She knew what she was getting into to begin with. I was already a journalist. I was already traveling a lot in the Middle East. When we met, there was, you know, I was going between Afghanistan and other places. Actually, the first time we had a conversation over the phone, I was in Kabul, and she was a producer on the Martha Stewart Show. And as luck or the strangest thing in the world, I was a guest on the Martha Stewart Show. So she did the pre-interview with me. in Kabul.
Oh my
and God. Started talking, and then I went, I was on the show in the studio, yeah. And you know, we started talking, one thing led to another, and we went out for a drink, and here we are.
So there you go.
So she knew, this was no surprise when the first conversation you have with the soon to be boyfriend, then later to be husband, right. And he's in Kabul.
Yeah.
You know what you're getting into. Yeah,
it's a little different than the typical romance where you start out down the street from each other or another state. I wanted to talk about a lot so much with you, but the COVID-19 and your coverage of that, which has been some of the best out there. And, you know, this is something I've been talking about. Yeah. I mean, we've never seen this in our lifetime, and I don't think we're ever see it again in the sense of a global pandemic and the entire world shut down. And you had a really interesting observation, quoting you, you said, and you were talking regarding the flu as we know it now. You said, we understand that there's a tax that we have to pay for our humanity. I mean it metaphorically. Now we have a new tax, meaning COVID-19, a new thing that we have to pay for living on the planet, for living on top of each other, for exploiting our environment. And we just don't know how heavy that tax burden is going to be. It was really, I never thought of it that way, and you're right. And do you see COVID as an outcropping of the way we're living? And
yes, entirely. I'm glad you picked up on that, because that is how I see this crisis. Obviously, it's a pandemic. Obviously, it's something we want to get past us, but we all know that. The way I see it is, it's a tax that we have to pay because we have been terrible guests on this planet. Mm-hmm. We go into environments and habitats where we shouldn't. We eat wildlife like that we shouldn't, like bats and pangolins and other things. We live on top of each other. We live in generally unsanitary conditions. Our general health, I think, because of the way we live, is relatively poor. And I think of the flu as a tax. And the flu is a tax that comes around every year. And the flu does take a heavy burden. It takes, you know, 350,000 people a year die to the flu globally. And we've accepted that, and that's part of the tax we have to pay for living on top of each other, polluting the world, burning down and bulldozing into natural habitats. And now we have another one, and we don't know what the bill is going to be. I think the bill is going to be really high for the first 2 years. Maybe it's going to be higher than that, you know, 300,000, maybe it's 600,000, maybe it's 700,000, maybe it's a million. I don't know. You can look at different models that are out there. And then, you know, after we get some sort of medical treatment or a vaccine or a series of vaccines, the tax burden is going to go down. It's going to be another, what is it, 1% of humanity that is sacrificed for being terrible hosts on the planet? Yeah. And I don't mean to sound callous like that. I know each person is an individual, but you're asking about when you look at the globe that we live on and our tens of thousands of years of recorded history on this planet.
Right.
That's the way I encapsulate it.
One of the big reasons I wanted to talk to you is because you have a perspective that a lot of people don't have. You are literally all over the world, and never more so than today. We tend to be living in our own lanes, especially politically, especially in America, but just generally. And, you know, sure, a lot of us or people watching this have gone to Europe or traveled to Russia for a week or two for vacation, but you are on the ground year after year.
I'm a vagabond.
What exactly? That's what your wife said. Your wife told me that. I said I wouldn't repeat that on the thing, but she called you a vagabond.
That would make her a vagabond too. She joined the circus.
She showed her hand. That's right. Why is this global warming issue and what we're doing to the planet, does it seem to be falling on deaf ears only in America, or is it? My sense is that internationally, a lot of the rest of the world gets it, and we don't. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, clearly, in parts of China, they didn't get it either.
Right.
And that let's put aside for a second that the conspiracy theories that this was bioengineered in a lab in Wuhan. Let's put that aside for a second.
Right.
And then unleashed in order to, you know, plot to take over the world. Right. But most theories are that this happened naturally somehow. When we say naturally, it's not natural that you go into an uninhabited area, you pull out all of the rare wildlife, you chop them up on wooden blocks, and you sell them by the bag. Mm. But that's what we believe, or what the scientists who I've spoken to believe happened at the time of the outbreak. And that can happen again. These bats and other wildlife have other viruses inside of them. And you go into areas where you shouldn't, and you're going to come into contact with them. And the reason, and another thing is, these wildlife markets, they put animals together that wouldn't normally meet in nature. So if there's a bat virus that lives in bats, and there's a civet cat in a cage below it, and they're interacting through feces or otherwise, that wouldn't normally happen in the wild in a natural environment because they live in separate environments. But you bring them together, you put them into a cage, and then you chop them up on a chopping block with the same knife, bad things are going to happen.
Right.
So I do think there is an environmental message in this as well, that you harm the planet that you live on, the planet fights back.
Did you see that? I mean, a lot of people are saying, okay, so you hear, you know, when there was a transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, they talked to them about a plan to deal with pandemic, and there's always a plan in place. But it's always been that thing, at least for a citizen like myself.
Always been ignored, right? It's always been ignored. Going back to 9/11, when they were warning about pandemics, it's always that thing. Hey, be careful. This is the one that's going to come and bite you, and be careful. And it's pushed on the shelf. Look at this, since we're talking globally here. Right before 9/11, there was a major U.S. intelligence assessment that focused entirely on pandemics. It was 60-plus pages. And it was talking about influenza pandemics, that pandemics are going to come from Asia, and they're going to be difficult. And it was a blatant warning in 2000. Well, we all know what happened in 2001. And then after 2001, we spent all of our time and our resources chasing terrorists in the Middle East. So there are, you know, your focus as a nation, your emphasis, your dollars, your troops go one place. And look at what happened to the United States. Since 9/11, we have spent 2 decades fighting a global war on terrorism, chasing people in primarily the Middle East and Islamic world, developed very, very sophisticated man-tracking capabilities, tracking your phones, tracking your whereabouts, tracking patterns of life. The U.S. intelligence has gotten exceptionally good at man-tracking in a way that that wasn't available in the Cold War days.
Right.
And that warning, that Cassandra moment that happened before 9/11 got pushed aside. And there were others. When SARS happened, there were also outcries saying, we're not prepared for this pandemic, but it wasn't the urgent need at the moment, or seen to be the urgent need at the moment. Then it was ISIS, or then it was always something else. And so now it happened. And I don't know if this is even going to be a wake-up call. Maybe even after this, we're going to, you know, in 5 years when this passes, they're going to be people who say, you know, it wasn't that bad. You and the media exaggerated it. I survived it. My grandma didn't die. What do I care? And they're going to go back to whatever it is the priority of the moment is.
Well, here's the thing that I've been concerned about is how divisive things have become. You know, I'll occasionally go on CNN, MSNBC as a quick commentator or whatever, and I would go on Fox News, and I stopped going on because I don't want to make this a partisan thing. I couldn't go on that network anymore, given that they'd become essentially an arm of the Trump administration. So be that as it may, we're so divided and so divisive. And my heart sank seeing those protesters recently protesting the right to go back to work at the expense of human lives, but couching it clearly felt political, right? Like that they had an agenda, and the underlying agenda was to help make sure Trump gets reelected by getting the economy back on track, et cetera, et cetera. Is the world as divisive as we are or seem to be in America, either politically, socially, or culturally? Because for me, personally, it's gotten alarming here in the country.
Okay, so there's two different aspects to that preamble. So one is the debate about when society should open and should we close. Absolutely, that is happening internationally. That everyone is wrestling with this. And frankly, it's a legitimate debate because there aren't any real good answers. You can't close down society forever and keep everyone locked inside. That does have a serious cost, and you don't want to have societal economic collapse. just on a micro level, there's been huge spikes in domestic violence because of all of this tension and closures. So it is not sustainable to keep it forever and keep society as we know it. That said, everyone knows you got to do this for a little while. It's temporary. Stick together. We'll get over the hump. Be a little patient and we'll get there. And that debate is natural and normal. People coming out onto the streets with AR-15s and harassing medical staff, that's not normal. That's not happening elsewhere. That is bonkers.
How did we get here? How did this country get to this point that we are so, everybody's holding on so tight regarding politics? I'm just curious what your
I think there's a lot to talk about, but yeah. I think it's education. You know, I think as a nation, we haven't invested a lot in education for the last many years. And I think that has been a real problem. I think that's paying us back. People aren't engaged in intellectual debates, aren't prepared to engage in debates because they don't know enough history. People who are not educated are easily manipulated by either side, frankly. So I think it's education. I think it's not cohesion and national unity. The United States is a united country. We're very patriotic, more patriotic than most nations. I just don't think we've spent enough time equipping our people to have real in-depth debates and discussions. It immediately becomes tribal. It immediately becomes aggressive. It immediately becomes angry and violent. You know, here in the UK, you turn on the TV and there's a debate about people, whether we should open the economy now or we should wait or we should do a slow roll and how slow it should be. It's civil and normal and you can follow it. Mm-hmm. I follow the press briefings here and in many countries around the world. There's a scientist, there's journalists who ask questions. The scientists or the political leaders at the podium ask the journalist, excuse me, sir or ma'am, do you have a follow-up question? And they listen, and they answer, and they don't interrupt each other, and they're having a real discussion about real things that really matter. So that course of preparedness for a civil discourse, I think, has been lost recently, and I don't know what it goes back to.
Yeah.
I remember the advent of shock jock radio. I remember when Morton Downey Jr.
Yeah.
was on TV, and it was fun. Yeah. And you got, you know, they would shout down each other, and it was just, stupid versus stupid.
Yeah,
and that's not a good way to have debates about things that matter.
You know, my brother-in-law lives in Denmark. He's American and in college, met a woman there and he's studying abroad. And he's been living there for 25 years. And it's very similar to what you just described about the UK. There's a civility to it. And, you know, he said now lately, the last several years, maybe even before Trump, I'm not Trump bashing. It's just, he says, sometimes I'm embarrassed to be an American because and I'm curious on a larger scale internationally.
People are holding their heads. People are holding their heads in confusion and wonderment. Some Americans abroad are holding their heads in shame. I mean, there were announcements on the radio today here in the UK, don't drink bleach. You know, don't follow this crazy, but they didn't make it seriously because they didn't actually think people would go out and say, oh, President Trump said you should potentially inject cleaning products into yourself. They were saying, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And obviously, you just need to read what the instructions on the bottle and you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But they were talking about it, a little bit of a public warning. Hey, don't advise this, but more of a, do you believe what's going on over there? So when each nation has had a reaction to this, and every country has had, I think, a revealing approach. And it is, when you like all pressure, when you apply huge pressure, it reveals the inner structure of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And whether it's pressure on our personalities to reveal if we're good people or bad people, pressure on our families to see if that relationship is strong enough to survive, pressures on our societies, they reveal the inner core, the inner essence of it. And some countries have failed and some countries have not. So you look at Germany, for example, they've done really well. They have a good healthcare system, they're organized, they were quick, and they put this virus into a box relatively quickly. And by the way, it wasn't brain surgery. They reacted quickly. They were honest with their people. They tested and they isolated the people who were sick because they had tested. That's it. There was no special magic sauce. Yeah. Singapore did pretty much the same. It's seeing a little bit of a new spike again. Hong Kong did pretty much the same. Organized approaches. China, we saw what China's nature is because it immediately went into full totalitarianism. It locked everything down. It mobilized the party. It locked people inside. It arrested whistleblowers. We still don't know what the numbers are out of there. Well, that was revealing about the nature of the one-party state in China, just as it was revealing about the state of German democracy or the state of Italian democracy. So the Italians, after kind of vacillating for a little while, united in a way that is only Italian. They were singing from their balconies and playing music to each other. And people, have you seen the story from Verona, that Romeo and Juliet, two people fell in love in Italy on opposite balconies?
Oh, really? That's awesome. Yeah. No, I didn't see that. That's great. Great stuff. I got to check it out.
It's revealing about the national character.
Right.
What has this been revealing about the state of the U.S. right now?
Yeah.
It's not good.
No.
You're living it. You know what it's revealing. Well, divisiveness, anger, misinformation, no policy, this, that, and the other place every day. It seems to be all over the place with certain states stepping up, certain states not. Just a real mixed bag.
Right. And I'm curious, and I know this may be difficult to answer, but if you can, from a global perspective, has the perception of the rest of the planet or the parts that you feel comfortable talking about?
Yes, in my conversations with the rest of the planet this morning.
Exactly. Well,
they told me.
You're an intrepid reporter. Sources say.
Has the perception of America changed globally regarding America significantly as a result of this? Was it already sort of a not a great perception that they had of us before this?
It's funny. And I obviously, I didn't do a survey this morning of the 8 billion
well,
people.
You should have. Jesus.
Yeah, I know. Call me back. Give me an hour. Yeah. But in the friends that I've been speaking to in various European countries, analysts, I make a lot of phone calls. It's not that people are saying, oh, you Americans are so dumb and you people are, what is wrong with you? There is a natural debate, and some people do think that the U.S. is on the right path. They don't think that they want to see societies closed down. Some people say, listen, we got to get back to work, and they're counting on the U.S. as the financial driver of the world to get the world economy back on track. Mm-hmm. So there are people, reasonable people, who say, okay, good. America has to start the car again. Otherwise, we're all going to be left on the road waiting for the next ride.
Right.
So there's that. And then there are people who point to just the bizarre nature of Trump and say, this is the strangest politician that they've ever seen in elected office in America or elsewhere. So not everyone looks at Trump and says, oh, America's flushed down the toilet by any means.
Has our divisiveness here fed it around the world? Has it?
They're linked. The Brexit movement. There's a lot of sort of far right movement, the Viktor Orban movement. I've done plenty of stories on that. I had a whole hour just on that, on how far right movements and sometimes what are called identitarian movements. Not all of these groups like to be called the far right, so they say they are identitarian movements. We're not against immigrants or Muslims. They're fine, but they're fine in their own places. We want to celebrate our own identity as Austrians or Germans or Italians or French or whatever happens to be. And they definitely find a common ground with the kind of the Steve Bannon sort of original Trump message. And whenever he does something against immigration, they think he's a big hero.
What is you've covered complex stories for a long time all over the world. Covering this virus, the most complex? I mean, you did say that there's a balance that you have to strike where you want people to take precautions, but you don't want to induce panic and you don't want to collapse the global economy. Are you balancing that every day that you're doing reporting, whether it's you know, for the show.
I don't try and strike that balance because I don't think I have that ability. You know, I can't think, should I do this report or is it going to knock down the global economy? Yeah. I don't have that kind of sway. I mean, that would be total hubris.
Yeah, yeah.
But I, you know, I tell it as I hear it, right? If a story comes, good, bad, indifferent, it happens, it happens. But I do think you don't want to become hysterical. And maybe because I've been in a lot of terrible places before, I'm not prone to hysteria. I've seen people get nervous before. I've seen people die before. I've seen lots of people die before. And I've seen societies recover as well. So I'm not necessarily convinced that our world will never be the same and that things are forever different. I think there will be a shadow, but I think when the sun rises again, that shadow might recede more quickly than we think. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Right.
Perhaps this will have a long shadow that's going to kill the grass where the sun isn't shining, and we're going to be dealing with this for a long time, and weeds are going to grow there to keep the analogy going. But I don't know yet. But I do think it's important not to panic and not to get hysterical. And just because, well, frankly, because people are dying. I've covered a lot of stories where people die.
When the president suspended funding for the World Health Organization, I mean, how much of that do you feel is just a political posturing? And what is the perception of the World Health Organization around the world? How did the rest of the world, how is the rest of the world, the bulk of the world reacting to that?
So the World Health Organization, first of all, and I spoke to former members of the World Health Organization specifically about this, they're not convinced it's going to happen. You know, a lot of what Trump says doesn't mean necessarily that the dollars are going to fall because there's funding and there's a lag time between when you cut off funding and when you have to, the money that they have, and will the system keep going despite that order? That's one. And two, they thought it was a blatant political move, another attempt to distract and to blame and to say, oh, the World Health Organization has no credibility. It's a bunch of China stooges. And I'm going to, they're Chicken Little. They're crying that the world is going to end. And I don't like their message. So I'm going to, you know, try and shut them down. It was a little bit like when the US walked out of the Paris Climate Accords.
Right.
It didn't end the environment. It's not like the world after US walking out of the agreement that suddenly there was a massive change to the global environment. It's still polluted. It's still horrible. It's still not necessarily getting better, except maybe it's having a little breathing room right now.
Right.
But it sent a message that this administration didn't care about these issues.
Yeah. And, you know, it also feeds one of his important through lines, which is us versus them, right? Like it's sort of
this. Which doesn't really apply when you're talking about air and pandemics. You know, there's a lot of overlap between, and that's why I keep going back to this, between the environment and a pandemic.
Right.
Because one, there's no dateline. You know, you said, well, at the top of your show, oh, we're going to be sophisticated. We're going international today. I was like, this is a pandemic, dude. Like, it's everywhere. It's no, there's no here or there. It's like, cough, you're going to get it, vice versa.
Exactly.
And the same thing with the environment. You know, you burn a coal factory in China or in Belarus, we're all going to suffer from it. They're going to suffer more because it's right there and gravity brings the stuff down. But generally, we're all breathing the same air.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, when you're covering a story, you know, you talked about, especially going to a war zone, that, you know, you're looking at the rebel group, you have to figure out the social dynamics. I'm really fascinated by that, like just how you do your job, and especially in war zones. And talk about that a little bit. I'm curious.
So this is very different, right? So when you're in a war zone, you're dealing with people. You're dealing with angry, generally young men, and they are often armed. Sometimes they're high. Sometimes they're operating illegal schemes. You have to quickly figure out who you're talking to, what their angle is, how they see you, what they want from you, what you can do to protect yourself by making them happy. You're thinking about your vehicle. Do I have enough gas in it? Is my driver loyal? If the shots start to come, is he going to run away? are my shoes tied? You know, you're thinking very practical things about your situational awareness, and it's all around the people that you're with, how you, the clothing that you wear. I'm a foreigner. I'm an American. I look American. I'm suddenly in the Middle East, and am I wearing what, military style clothing, cargo pants, and kind of a jacket with epaulets? Mm-hmm. That sets a profile.
Yeah.
Or do I kind of look like a, you know, some of the photographers with the scarf around the neck and the kind of the tattoos? That sets a profile too. So for women, it's a particularly important because it's their physical presence is so noticed in environments like this. When covering a pandemic, it's a little bit like when I covered Fukushima. You're dealing with a threat that has no social interaction. Mm-hmm. It has no brain. It has no politics. You don't mean anything to it except a possible wet surface to stick to. So it's a very different way of thinking. You know, you're dealing with a war zone, you're always worrying about the logistics, the cars, the presence, the language, the reliability of the people, their politics, their changing politics. And this, you have to think of what you're touching, what other people have touched, how long it lasts, the health of your family, this incubation period of 2 weeks, more or less, which you show no symptoms. It's a different, totally different headspace.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could find that would be similar was I was in Fukushima after the nuclear reactor blew up. And I went into the exclusion zone, right? This was a little, not in the immediate aftermath, some time had passed. And I went into the exclusion zone because the nuclear reactor blows up, right? And similar to this, similar to the virus, the radiation, they're particles. There's little bits and pieces of dust that settle. And that's the danger. It's not like the place is just glowing and pulsing like a microwave oven and it's hot. No, it's the little particles of radioactive material that, like a virus, if you kick them up and you breathe them in, it's a real problem. But if you get them on even if you get them on your skin, it's not a big deal. They're not strong enough to get through your skin. Or if you get them on one of those plastic coverall suits, it's no big deal. But then what do you do with the suit? How do you take it off? Where do you dispose of it? Like you can see where it goes.
Yeah.
So I was in Fukushima. A guy was going in. He had lived there. And we were going back in to collect some equipment. The government had given him special access to go in and recover some very, very expensive machine tools that he made that was part of his business. So I tagged along with him, and we were there, and I had one of those radiation detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like you could see, to use the virus comparison, like you could see where the virus was.
Wow.
And it lives in places where you'd expect it to live. On a smooth road, almost nothing, because the wind moved it aside. In the grass on either side, really, really, really intense.
Wow.
Because the grass has a lot of surface area, it traps it. Okay. The leaves of the trees covered. Wow. In houses, it was particularly in the gutters, because the rain would concentrate all this stuff into the corners of the houses.
Right.
And it was a similar kind of thinking, where you have to think about floating particles that you don't want to get into your mouth or nose.
Right. Well, listen, this is it's so great to have you on. There's so much more I'd love to talk to you about. I know we have to jump, but on assignment on NBC, you're reporting on NBC News with Nightly News with Lester Holt on MSNBC. It's really great to have you on, and thanks for taking time away from the family. And hope we can do this again sometime and check in every once in a while, because I could talk to you forever.
All right, look forward to it.
All right, there you go, Richard Engel. What a great guy. And I was really excited to have him on, as I said, because he I'm able to talk to somebody and able to get you guys to hear somebody that's really in the thick of it, literally all over the world, so that we kind of get a worldview outside of the world that we have from our own perspective here being in the United States. So I hope you enjoyed that. And go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio, and check out some of my videos and also subscribe. Thanks, folks. We'll catch you next week.